Hello and welcome to another episode of the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
The podcast that brings you the chronological history of the Second World War seen through the silver screen. We've got the best film ever made, Simon, coming up right now.
Kinda. Just a quick disclaimer. This is one of Dan's favourite films. It might even be his favourite. It's definitely his favourite at the moment. I thought it was very good. I didn't like it as much as Dan, but I don't think there's anyone on earth who likes this film as much as Dan. And this film is, Dan?
We are watching and discussing the brilliant and very underrated... Stop. The brilliant and very underrated Commandos Strike at Dawn. Now, don't let the title put you off.
No, because it's one of the worst titles ever.
Because not only is it one of the worst titles ever, there isn't very much Striking at Dawn, or indeed Commandos, for that matter. We have to wait quite a while for them.
Oh, but when they arrive, there is a shipload of them, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a bunch of Commandos when they finally arrive. There's a lot of them.
So this movie, Commando Strike at Dawn, I suppose the key thing about it is it's starring the absolutely amazing Paul Mooney, star, of course, of Howard Hawks's Scarface, which was written by Ben Hecht. And it was directed, this movie was directed by a chap called John Farrow. And he, well, you may know him from movies such as Around the World in 80 Days and Wake Island. He also did a great film called His Kind of Woman with Bob Mitchum and Jane Russell. And what was the film you were talking about that he did earlier? Night Has a Thousand Eyes.
Has a Thousand Eyes. Come on.
So the screenplay of this movie is by someone which we will come across again later, a very, very talented writer, Irwin Shaw, probably best known for his novel, The Young Lions, which was made into the great movie with Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, and Dean Martin. But we'll get to that one in a few years, I'm sure. Irwin Shaw did plenty of screenplays, though. He did in the French Style, The Big Gamble, Take One False Step, Talk of the Town. But he didn't write the original story of this. That is actually based on a short story. I think it's a short story. It might have even been a feature in a magazine,
right,
or a novella by the great C.S. Forrester, who, of course, wrote many a book about the sea, most famous series of which is...
The Hornblower series.
Yes.
Exactly. Horatio Hornblower.
Yep.
But also wrote the novel and is accredited in the movie titles for African Queen.
Yes.
I mean, so much. I mean, this guy...
Of course, and Tom Hanks made Greyhound. That's one of his stories as well.
Exactly.
So, we'll get to that at a later date as well, I'm sure.
Well, we will, much later. We've got in about 8 years.
Yeah, maybe.
But, I mean, just to begin with, the director of John Farrow, the writer in the form of Irwin Shaw, based on a story by C.S. Forrester, isn't a bad start. Come on.
No, and starring Paul Mooney. It's cracker. And it is a great, great film. I just don't think it's the best film ever made. That's the only difference between our opinions. It's very well lit, right? It's got
It's a noir, isn't it?
It's absolutely a film noir, a subgenre of war film with film noir, with a smattering of film noir. But the lighting is so good, and how bright and sunny Norway looks just before the occupation, when they're all sort of going about their business, happily working hard as good Norwegians should. How they're portrayed as this very hardworking and moralistic, ethical group of people. And then the tones of the the shades of grey start creeping in once the occupation starts. That by the end, it's all very noir. The dark meetings of resistance, all of that. It's very good. It's really shocking. There was parts when I actually had to look over at Dan, and and I was slightly upset, wasn't I? I was just like, what? Hold on a minute. They've just murdered someone. They've thrown him into the icy fjord.
Yeah.
To his death. Yeah. He was an informer. So you get a lot of that. It's that kind of movie, right? It's basically a very straightforward resistance film.
Yeah. So here's an interesting thing, Simon, because I've got a feeling that the war in Norway had a much larger and more significant impact upon certainly the British population. I'm not sure to what extent the American population, than we imagine it would now. So this is only one of quite a few films that were filmed during the war. So that's between 1939 and 1945, which showed especially the Norwegian resistance movement against the invading Nazis, but certainly the Nazi occupation of Germany. They include films such as They Raid by Night, The Commandos Have Landed, First Comes Courage, and Edge of Darkness. And we're going to definitely cover a couple of those.
Well, because They Raid by Night is great. I think that's set in 41, though.
Yeah, this film is another one that covers some time. So, I mean, it was filmed in 1942, in the summer of 1942. I guess we're to assume it covers up to about the end of 1941, but it very much starts at the outbreak of the war and certainly the invasion of Norway by the Germans.
On April 9th, yeah.
The exact same day they invaded Denmark. Mm-hmm. The Norwegians held out for quite a bit longer than the Danes did.
Yeah, well, they didn't have any punctures to fix on their bikes, did they? Yeah. I think that was the big difference. They had what appeared to vehicles that moved, which didn't require pedalling. They also had the fjords, of course. That's one thing I wanted to ask you about.
Go on.
I was watching that and looking at it. First of all, the cynical side of me was like, that's not Norway. You're having a laugh. That's Burbank. And then there are shots of the fjord. And I'm like, that's got to be Norway.
Well, it's a little confusing, Simon, because I might be wrong. I might be misremembering this, but I seem to think that at the beginning of this film, which is pretty nondescript, it's sort of grey titles. This whole film is black and white, by the way, obviously. That it says filmed on location in the villages of Norway. Now, I've done some research and I've found out that's absolutely, completely not true.
Ah, where is it filmed then?
They filmed it in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada.
Really?
And the reason why the commandos at the end of this film, who are attacking at dawn, let's not forget, are all Canadian.
Could be bloody any time, mate. Yeah.
The reason they're all Canadian.
Commandos strike at high tea. That's what I would have done.
Commandos strike at elevenses.
Yeah. gin and cucumber sandwiches on the lawn.
Yeah, but they do actually strike at dawn in this film. But all the commandos are Canadian. They're the Royal Canadian Commandos. You will see, when you watch this film, which I highly recommend you do watch it, you'll see that when commandos do strike at dawn, it definitely looks like they're not just a bunch of extras they've hauled in off the street. These are guys who certainly seem to know what they're doing. And the reason for that is both the Germans and the Allied commandos are played by actual Canadian commandos.
Ah, interesting. Well, that's good. That's very realistic. And that, you know, parts of the film are very realistic. And as I said, parts of it quite bizarrely shocking for a film of its age. But the action is really full on, and it's like you stand back and think, wow, I mean, this is a really, really professional job. I mean, that sounds like I'm patronizing it because it's an old movie, but I love old movies, especially film noir. So I'm not pandering. I'm just saying it's a slick, taut, super well-made film.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, here's a bit of trivia for you that you'll quite enjoy.
Here we go.
So there was an original score for this film that was rejected. Do you know who composed this original score, Simon?
Well, I'm going to guess because I don't know. Can I guess?
Yeah, go on.
Bernard Herrmann.
Incorrect.
Right.
The original score was composed by...
Barry Manilow.
That's it! How did you know? I can't imagine why they rejected it. At the Copacabana. Igor Stravinsky.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty highbrow. Why on earth did they reject that? Sorry, Stravinsky, you're just not up to the task.
And really, the score is nothing to write home about. It's one of the few parts that does not stand out. But if you've managed to persuade Igor Stravinsky to write your score for your film, you got to go with it, don't you?
Well, maybe he thought it was too good for the film. Maybe he saw the rush of the film and he's like, I'm not putting my music to that.
No, he was rejected. And he actually published the unused music as titled Four Norwegian Moods. So you can look that up and have a listen and watch the film on mute.
Stravinsky strikes at dawn. Right.
Or didn't, as the case may be.
Yeah.
So let's start with a little bit of history because it was a very fierce and bloody occupation because with the exception of France, no other country resisted their German invaders quite as much. You could say the Russians, but they were never actually occupied. Mm. But out of the occupied countries, the Norwegian resistance, for what most of this film is about, were really fierce and they did not let up. So although the Germans initially invaded on April 9th, the same day they invaded Denmark, they didn't actually conquer. And in terms of like hostilities were over until the 10th of June. Now, obviously, there's a very quite famous person involved in this who has now become a synonym for being a traitor. And that was the role that Vidkun Quisling played. Mm. Vidkun Quisling, if you're described as being a Quisling, it's basically being a traitor to your country. Quisling was the leader of Norway's fascist party. And the second that the Germans arrived, he basically installed himself as the leader
of
the puppet government. Yeah. Exactly. The Third Reich and Hitler and his cronies were absolutely obsessed with Viking lore, weren't they? I mean, it was this whole thing. And so to be actually taking over these countries that were the epicenter of what they considered to be the perfect human being, I think they assumed that they were basically going into countries that were, you know, going to welcome them with open arms.
Yeah. Now, what you had, of course, in this film, the occupying commander calls them all his brethren. I think German brethren, basically. We're here to make your lives better, although it looks pretty good already. And of course they don't. And just quickly about Quisling, I've got a very close mate of mine, English guy, but he lives in Norway.
Our friend John.
John, exactly. Yeah, John Harmon. And he, you know, I've had a chat with him about the Quisling thing. And the big thing, it seems, is what were called the Quisling children. And this is a kind of stain that will, you know, can never be removed. And it's the Quisling children as far as I can work out, were the children of victims of rape by the Nazis, or also collaborators, but Norwegian women's children, one of which is the one of the singers from ABBA, right? She's one of the prison children.
Really?
So, yeah. So it's fascinating. It's because it's so dark and so miserable. It's like the Joy Division. Do you know what I mean? They were used. It was like a factory farm for Aryan children.
So what Simon was discussing was the Lebensborn program, where basically several thousand Norwegian women had children fathered by German soldiers in an attempt to create this perfect Aryan race. I mean, it's just an appalling thing when you think about it, isn't it?
It's a big thing. It's become much, much greater than that one man, or much more infamous than just that one man.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the Norwegians gave a pretty good account of themselves, and at the outbreak of the war, when they were invaded, they certainly did not go quietly. Mm. On the first day, they sank the German flagship that was involved in the invasion. And the interesting thing is, in sinking Blücher, which was filled with German soldiers ready to invade, they really put a serious dent in the invasion plans.
Yeah.
A storm on the day of the invasion prevented the Royal Navy from being as involved as they had wanted to be. Both the British and the Norwegians had been sort of waiting for this to happen. It was a sort of inevitability. But as I say, they put up enough of a resistance that the royal family could escape. And then what followed was a sort of long drawn out thing. The British were very keen to get their hands on the huge Norwegian merchant marine fleet. You know, when every vessel counted and they knew how much that was going to be important to them, the Norwegian merchant marine became quite a huge part of the British plans in terms of stockpiling and keeping trade routes open and that sort of thing. Now, at the height of the war, there were 40,000 resistance fighters in Norway, and right. I mean that's quite a sizable movement. I don't think Denmark had 40,000 soldiers at the beginning of that.
Mm.
And they fought.
That's crazy, isn't it?
I know it is. And they fought on two fronts: the home front, which they called, here we go, you ready for this, Hegemonfronten, and the external front, which was Utefronten. So the home front basically consisted of what you would imagine of sabotage, raids, clandestine operations, that sort of thing. Whereas the external front was entirely about Norway's merchant fleet, the Royal Norwegian Navy, many of which had managed to escape and find harbour in Britain. And the reason why Norway was so important is it really is just a little hop and a skip across the North Sea to Scotland.
Yeah.
And given that Britain was basically looking at being the last man standing in the western drive of the Wehrmacht, having the Germans just off, you know, sitting there in Norway was as menacing as I'd imagine as them sitting in France and Calais.
Yeah, well, or Jersey and Guernsey.
Yeah, exactly. You know. So about 80,000 Norwegian citizens fled the country during the war. Throughout the war, there was a continuous back and forth between Norway and the UK of men and materials, and certainly merchant trade. And it sort of became a back door into Britain of resistance fighters. Certainly a lot of Jews managed to escape Norway in that way. I think they said, Norway wasn't particularly, didn't have a huge Jewish population. So in terms of the cost of the Holocaust in Norway, At the start of the war, there were roughly 2,100 Jews in Norway. Now, 775 of these were arrested, detained, and/or deported. 742 were sent to concentration camps. The Norwegians did a pretty good job of getting, well, more than half of their Jewish population out of the country. And many, many of them ended up in the UK and often came back, as in this film, as commandos, given that they knew the country so yeah. well.
Just regarding tonight's film.
Let's get to the greatest film ever made.
Okay. There are many parts, like little snippets. I was just going through my notes of when I was watching it. Interestingly, the letter he receives, if you look at the return postal address, is Surlingham in Norfolk, where...
Yeah, you got quite excited about
it. Almost... got really excited.
Almost as excited as you did about the forestry and logging industry of Denmark.
I bowled over by that.
Not many logs in this, I'm afraid.
Which is really strange, because the Norwegians are like the king of logging, you know. So, I mean, I've got a wonderful book called Norwegian Wood, which is just about chopping wood. It's amazing. Can't recommend that enough. Makes not a great Christmas present if anyone's interested.
Not to be confused with a Beatles song.
No, though. Exactly. Or Scandinavian porn. You've got Surlingham. You've got Surlingham, Norfolk. That's like top of my list. The 6:30 p.m. curfew. I found that very interesting. I didn't know that seems very early for a curfew. It's just like blimey. It's like
You've barely got the dinner on.
Christ, I haven't even got the dinner on at 6:30. But what I thought about that is just that that gives people more time to sit at home and hate the Germans, you know, to hate their occupiers. It just build up further resentment. I found that a very bizarre choice.
What it does it means the middle third of this film is basically people meeting in dark, dark houses of their neighbors and having these whispered plans for resistance. All done by candlelight, because they are, you know, not allowed out in the streets.
One of the things which really shocked me, I said earlier, I was shocked quite a few times in this film. I'd say three to be exact, but one of the shocking things,
very exact,
was when the outside the school. And when the Nazis are basically full on occupied, after the time they've popped in and said, "Oh, everything's going to be great. We're brothers." And then it's like cut to like 24 hours later, they're burning books from the school, and the swastika is the flag flying above the school and town hall. It's like, whoa. Teacher comes out and speaks to the Nazis burning the books, and he says, "I'm writing a novel. I'm writing a novel too at the moment. I'd be very disappointed if you chose not to burn it," which I thought was a great line. That was brilliant.
It's one of my favourite lines in the film, spoken by George MacReady, the actor, making his film debut. Here's a little trivia for you about George MacReady. get a load of his filmography. So this is the guy who plays the teacher in this, who's brilliant. And by the way, everyone in this looks brilliantly Nordic. They're all blonde, very tall and handsome. So George MacReady, who plays the school teacher in this, was also in Gilda.
Oh, what a
with
movie.
Rita Hayworth. Yeah. Yeah. Paths of Glory. Oh, what a film.
What a movie.
The Great Race, even better. Wow. Tora, Tora, Tora. So no, we'll see him in that. What do you mean, no?
No, I've never been a fan. Sorry.
What are you talking about?
I've never been a fan of Tora, Tora, Tora. I've sat through it a few times thinking, what am I missing? Dan's mad about this film. What am I missing? And I came to the conclusion that just, you know, this time you just were wrong.
Wow.
But, I mean, for instance, Yesterday, I rewatched one of my favorites. From Here to Eternity, and
you know, which
deals with, you know, a lot of the same thing. It's far superior in every way. It's brilliant.
All right. Well, we'll come to that in about 2 years' time. he played Marullus in the Julius Caesar, the famous Julius Caesar, the Julius Caesar with Marlon Brando.
Oh, wow.
And he's one of about 10 cast members in this who were all in The Desert Fox, and including another film that I think you're going to really enjoy and I've never heard of before. And I only came across this because he and Paul Mooney are in this, a film called One Against Seven by a Russian director about some Russian soldiers who are in a sort of Mexican standoff, not to confuse the nationalities too much, but some Russian soldiers who are in a Mexican standoff with some German soldiers in Russia.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I knew you'd be excited.
That sounds like it's been made for me.
It was literally made for you.
Have you seen the top that I'm wearing?
You are. You look a bit like you've got your Soviet Submariner's t-shirt on, haven't you?
I've got my Northern Fleet undergarment, yeah.
Yeah. You look dashing in it. Thanks. So, listen, let's talk about the lead in this, who I think is absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
Well, and it's a great performance. So tell us about Paul Mooney, Simon.
Well, Paul Mooney is just one of those fascinating actors who is so much more than a movie star. You know, in a time when, without being rude, some of the acting leaves a little to be desired. Right. You just had to lead a film, and you know, as a leading man, you know, he had to be strong. But what he was so good at as an actor was sensitivity. And he does that brilliantly in this film. He's strong, yes, of course, he's the leading man, you know. He's very moralistic, but there is sweet sensitivity to him. And you watch that film, right? You watch the film we're talking about tonight, Commando Strike at Dawn, terrible title. And you can then you watch Howard Hawks' Scarface. It's mind-blowing. It's a different guy. I mean, yes, you're supposed to throw yourself into character, but that character is unrecognizable from this. And he is so menacing and he's terrifying in Scarface. You've got the whole incestuous thing going on with his sister, which of course was transferred into the Brian De Palma Pacino Oliver Stone remake.
This wouldn't be Brian De Palma who stole every idea he ever had, would it?
Well, being that this was a remake and Oliver Stone wrote it, you can't really blame De Palma for that. But no. Talking of Scarface, I mean, obviously De Palma paid homage, rather, to Hitchcock in pretty much everything, right?
And I thought that's a generous way of saying it.
And I was watching Scarface thinking, this is the only film where he hasn't taken any Hitchcock. And I'm just like, wait a minute, it's got the most violent shower scene in the history of cinema in it, just like Psycho, you know. So he even like transferred his grotesque. Now, so Mooney, right? Just back to him quickly.
Go on.
So fascinating thing about him is, first of all, he's not American, right?
No, he's Central European Jewish.
Yeah, he was born in what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and is now Ukraine, right? So he's Ukrainian. So there's that, which is bizarre. You know, I had no idea about that until I was researching him after watching Scarface. He's like an early sort of incarnation of a bit of Brando, a bit of Clift, definitely.
For sure.
And Pacino, who got the remake of Scarface made, absolutely loved him, right? When he saw the Paul Mooney Scarface, he was like, I've got to get this made. So he contacted Martin Bregman, the producer. It was just like, find a director. And originally it was going to be Sidney Lumet. Can you imagine? That would have been amazing.
Oh, wow.
But no, they went with the schlock of De Palma, which, I mean, it is an incredible film. It's just a very
mental, bizarre film. But anyway, we're not talking about that film. So when you do see a performance from an actor with the sort of gravitas that he has, it's a real shock. Do you know what I mean? Just like Spencer Tracy.
He is the center and the core of this film. He's described as a quiet fisherman. He's the quiet gentleman of this village who, when the village is overrun and occupied by the Germans, takes it upon himself to make a stand when no one else will. And he has this amazing speech, and he says, "I've lived a quiet life. The Germans have not lived quiet lives. We must learn from them how to become gangsters, thugs, useful with knife, dynamite, and poison." And this basically, this little speech, which is done in classic noir of deep, heavy shadows, yeah, and askew camera angles and deep, really intense close-ups on faces. This entire film is about faces to me. The director just flicks from face to face to face of these Norwegians all the time, whereas the Germans are left in these sort of long shots and are generally not treated in the same way. But these constant meetings in dark rooms lit by candlelight are the sort of the tone of the whole film. And we watch this man who's a single father. His wife died in childbirth. He's fallen in love with this British admiral's daughter. We'll get to him in a minute. And he's just being a regular Norwegian fella, and he becomes a resistance fighter. And we see montages, don't we, Simon, of you know, they stem from the absurd, like people, like a hand comes into frame and puts a big cross against the swastika, or you know, yeah, somebody blows something up. Two, we see the German commander of this village getting assassinated.
Yeah,
we see some old fella who's just finished reading the Bible with his missus. There's a knock on the door. He answers the door. Some German fella's like, "We are very lost. You must tell us the directions."
Amazing.
And he goes, "Make sure you turn left at the fork. Don't turn right. There's a cliff there. Turn left." And he's like, "Yeah, your roads are as bad as your food."
Yeah. Or instead of saying thanks, he basically then coats off the Norwegian populace. And so,
and their roads.
Yeah.
And there's a close-up of him, isn't there, Simon? As we hear the car drive away, and like, what's that? What was that pop song in the 50s? Dead Man's Curve or whatever,
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, Dead Man's Curve. Jan and Dean.
Jan and Dean. You hear this really exaggerated car crash.
Yeah.
With this intense close-up on this old Norwegian fisherman who's sort of closes his Bible and grins with satisfaction. There's another one.
I know. That's that was another moment. I was like, well, that's the guy that I called the Kirk Douglas takeout version.
Yeah. Like Kirk Douglas if you starved him.
Yeah. Kirk Douglas mixed with if he'd had a life of being a roadie for Happy Mondays.
No, there's an image for you. Jesus. Yeah, Kirk Douglas, but with lots of heroin.
Yeah.
Now, I want to tell you about something, Simon, because this is going to blow your mind.
I've heard that before.
What? One of the other main characters is arrested very early on because look, at the beginning of this film, bear with it. I said this to Simon. I said, just bear with the first 10 minutes because there's a lot of frothy Norwegians in national dress at a lovely wedding dancing to weird Norwegian music.
I've been to a Norwegian wedding.
Yeah, well, you know what it's like. So it does seem a little very, well, it seems a little, a lot Hollywood. Oh, look at the jolly Norwegians who are about to have their lives ruined. But one of the villagers that we meet is I guess he's an academic. He's the unofficial mayor or something or other. But he has quite strong political views. We learn this very early on. And the second the Germans are there, they call his name out. They're like, "Step forward. Yeah, we want to have a little chat with you, chum."
Yeah.
And he's taken away. Now, that character,
it's Johan, isn't it?
Yeah, is played by Ray Collins. Where do we know Ray Collins? Ray Collins played Valau in The Seventh Cross, the yeah, the basically the narrator, the man who takes us through that film.
Of course.
Yes. And you said you didn't like the look of him.
No. I liked him in that, though.
Yeah. Well, I think he's very good in this as well.
I mean, he was what he was supposed to be in this. At the beginning, an opinionated extrovert who, after being sent to the camps, comes back and is a broken man. But like beforehand, he is someone who speaks his mind constantly, even when people aren't interested. And,
yeah.
it's just smashed out of him by the Nazis, by the occupation and by torture, it seems.
He has a great quote, which keeps getting repeated. He staggers back into the village, having spent, I guess we think, weeks under interrogation by the Nazis. And he says, nobody, no civilized human being can know how bad they are. But he survived, and he's quite proud of the fact he survived. So he's one of Paul Mooney's, you know, right-hand men in the resistance, in the resistance war. Get a load of this. We didn't really cover him because he died almost immediately in The Seventh Cross, even though he was, you know, the voice of the, you know, of the film. He did three awesome Wells films. Citizen Kane, A Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil is amazing.
What a film.
Yeah.
And the Magnificent Ambersons.
Which is, well, all three of them are amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
But he also did The Heiress, starring Olivia de Havilland. But he's most famous, and our American listeners will know exactly who he is, because he played Lieutenant Tragg in the Perry Mason series.
Ah, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just looking. Oh, my God, more than 75 films.
Yeah, but he literally never stopped.
But known for Perry Mason. Can you imagine that, though? No offense to Perry Mason fans. In fact, I'm a huge fan of the remake. I think that's amazing.
Mm.
Can you imagine being in Citizen Kane and like people just want to talk to you about Perry Mason? You'd be fuming, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I was in Touch of Evil. That's great, but tell us about Perry Mason.
Yeah, tell us about Perry Mason.
So this is our second meeting with Ray Collins. So he's now on our leaderboard for most World War II films. Now, here's what's going to blow your mind. We meet at the beginning in this Norwegian wedding. Weirdly, it's never explained, but there's a British admiral, his son who's also in the Navy, and his very attractive daughter who seems to have the hots for Paul Mooney. But it's a very simple relationship they seem to have, isn't it?
They're simple and civilized.
And civilized and nice.
Yeah, like when you say got the hot, I mean, even saying the hots feels wrong.
It's a bit much, isn't
it? Like she's taken by him, that's for sure.
We know she sort of has the 1940s hots for him because we see her trying to write a letter to him in her house in Norfolk.
That's the worst accent I've ever heard in my life.
And she can't do it, and that's when she switches on the radio. We hear Chamberlain's address where he declares war.
Yeah.
And we don't see her again for quite some time.
No.
But her dad is Cedric Hardwick. So Cedric Hardwick, I mean, if you think that Ray Collins' filmography is extensive, Cedric Hardwick has basically done everything ever. Here's just a little. He also did a bunch of Hitchcock films.
Oh wow!
He did Suspicion and Rope.
Wow!
Love Rope. Yeah, Rope, one of my favorite films. He also did The Ten Commandments, War of the Worlds, Around the World in 80 Days, which was directed by our director in this.
Yeah.
He was also in Desert Fox, The Winslow Boy, which of course is the Terence Rattigan screenplay, Wing and a Prayer, which we'll definitely be doing as a war film. As we will, The Moon is Down, which is another Norwegian resistance film. He was in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So there is, it is surprising in its moments of real violence. I mean, we talked about the lovely old fella who's looking at his Bible and then directs a car full of Germans to their deaths. we see the commandant for the village assassinated. But probably the most chilling one is that our hero Paul Mooney decides he comes across some information which I'm not gonna spoil the movie for you. But the only thing he can do with it is get to Britain and tell his lovely friend the Admiral and his gorgeous daughter and his lovely son what's going on. so he persuades his fellow resistance members to take their little tiny rowboat and head for Britain across, as Simon said at the time, hang on, hold up. They're crossing the North Sea in that. But it does cover that. They do go, there's a montage of them, you know, bailing out and, you know, in the middle of a massive storm before they're rescued by a submarine. But there's a traitor amongst them. The owner of the village hotel, where all the Germans obviously make a beeline for that, they show up in the village, get out, and immediately march into the local hotel. This'll do us. Thanks very much. He's a traitor. Louis Jean Haidt is the actor who plays him. And he is, there's something quite sort of Aryan about him. Again, a great resume of his own. Listen, he was in Rawhide. If that doesn't sell you, nothing will.
Yeah, I remember at the beginning, because obviously the wedding is taking place at the hotel and he's working his butt off, isn't he? And yeah, he's shouting at his daughters and, you know, to do stuff and, you know, serve drinks, serve food, like, you know, basically lay it on. And his wife's working hard. And she kind of, you can tell immediately that she is his better half, like,
yeah,
completely.
Yeah. He's very serious, and done, she's like, done, oh, cheer up.
Yeah, it's done very well. She tells him to cheer up, and I think she, doesn't she give him a hug or something? And like, he does feel a little bit better, but like, he's a stress head completely. And I suppose running a hotel is quite stressful, and it becomes more stressful when the Nazis decide to use it as their office.
Yeah.
But yeah, he becomes a grass bastard.
Well, obviously in his time in serving the Nazis, he's decided, you know what? I think they've got a point.
Well, yeah, because that's what he suggests, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, he's drunk on the propaganda and he's lapping it up. He believes it all entirely.
Oh, and I've just realised he was in probably one of my top five favourite films ever. The most confusing plot of any film ever. He was in Humphrey Bogart's The Big Sleep.
Oh, another Howard Hawks movie.
Yeah,
great movie.
Great movie. Anyway, so this fella goes into the office of the now commander of the village, given that his superior was assassinated.
Yeah, he's our stereotypical Nazi, right?
Oh, he has the line. Hang on, I've got to find it. He says, Paul Mooney's gone to a little isolated house with his beautiful little daughter, who's very cute, and the Nazis arrive. So he has to hide down a well where he's basically hanging off the rope of the well with his daughter hanging around his shoulders. And it's incredibly tense, actually.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And there's, very well done. Again, there's overtones. I mean, I'd be really interested to know if Quentin Tarantino saw this, because that little bit where the Nazi interrogates the old lady who owns the house...
Yeah. Inglorious Bastards, right? That's what you're...
Yeah, and Paul Mooney's coat still on a chair that she's trying to sort of hide at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he announces that, yes, we might not have found him here. I'm not exaggerating. This is how bad he is. This is why he's the winner of the most stereotypical Nazi. He says, yes, but know this, that we have five people under arrest in the village, and if he is not turned in, that's Paul Mooney, we will shoot them one by one, and one of them is your nephew.
Yeah.
And she goes, but he's just a kid. To which the stereotypical Nazi says, yeah, it's quite possible to kill a boy.
Yeah, he's not very nice.
Anyway, yeah. This is
the... So the hotelier shops the boat crew, right?
Yeah, but explain how the hotel, the Nazi.
Well, this is great. Yeah,
the evil Nazi has a very cunning plan of how to catch them.
This is where it gets this bit's just bizarre, and it's like he gives him a dog whistle, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he gives him a dog whistle. It's just like when you're out in the fjord, blow the whistle, and he's what. Did he say that their dogs could hear it, or he's got some mechanism, and they've got some frequency mechanism, haven't they?
Well, they've got these listening devices, and they can triangulate the signal and send a boat out and get them.
So he asks him to blow it at that point when they're out there, and they'll come out and arrest them. And you think, first of all, it's just like, don't believe him. What are you doing? Don't believe him. He's a Nazi. Not only that, he's a right bastard Nazi as well.
He's a proper Nazi.
He's telling you what to do in your own house. And it's just like, please don't believe him. If you blow that whistle and they come out there, you're all dead. They don't care. They don't care about him. But he stupidly goes along with it. But his wife is in on it, almost like a double agent, and goes to Paul Mooney's character and informs on her husband. And that's a really tragic part of the film, because he's a dick, you know, but he's a husband and he's a father. And
I know, but she has that speech to Paul Mooney where she says, "I know he's my husband." And this is where this film does get dark on occasion in a really interesting and surprising way. She says, "Yeah, I know he's my husband. Yes, he's my children's father, but I cannot live with a man who has these beliefs anymore." And she basically tells Paul Mooney he's got this dog whistle and he's going to blow it. So cut to them rowing out to Britain through the fjord. Up on a hill somewhere, we've got the very, very evil Nazi with a spotlight ready, and they're waiting to hear the word.
Where "stop moving that light" comes from, times two in my notes.
It's a great little bit of naturalistic acting. Somebody moves the giant spotlight and it sort of bumps the evil Nazi officer and he's like, "Stop moving that light!" Anyway, the whole thing is intercut with the boat, which they're rowing out as silently as they can. And Paul Mooney's sitting next to the hotelier and giving him the old side eye. And they decide they've come far enough. They're going to ship oars and put the sail up. At which point, the hotelier goes for his handkerchief, like as though to blow his nose, and Paul Mooney grabs him. And the rest of the guys in the boat are like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah.
And he says, "Why don't you tell him about it?" And he eventually fesses up. And he's like, "All right, yes, I quite like what they have to say. They've got a point or two. Come on. They tie him up. While he's begging them, he's like, but I've known you since you were a child. And he's like, "You were married in my house." And they tie him up and chuck him in the fjord.
Yeah, that's really shocking. That's when I turned to you and I was like, "Damn." I was quivering.
I know. They tie him up.
I was really shocked at that.
And the camera stays on, as it does throughout this film, on faces. As they listen to his anguished cries in the fjord, "No, please, please, blah, 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 please, I, blah, blah." And he slowly drowns and sinks beneath the water.
Yeah, it's like, wow, that is dark. The violence when it happens, when it's one on one like this, like when they assassinate the Nazi leader and this part. It's really shocking, and so it should be, right? Whilst the battle scenes aren't shocking, but feel very realistic.
So, long and the short of it is, there is a moment where commandos do strike at dawn.
Well, they make it back to they do in that ridiculous boat. They do make it, don't they? They make it. And to cut a long story short, they go back to Norway with a shed load of commandos. Yeah. And they strike at dawn.
They do. And they have at it in a very commando-ish way. We're not going to spoil the ending for you, because it's actually a very surprising ending, given that this is a mid-war propaganda film. Right, Simon?
Yeah.
You were shocked at the end, weren't you?
Very. It's not the kind of thing you expect to see in a film from that age. It's as simple as that.
From the 70s, yeah.
From the mid-60s onwards, when depression was in.
When everything was bleak and meaningless.
Yeah.
But, listen, this is highly recommended. I think it is, I'm being a little facetious, it's not the greatest film ever made, but...
Funny. In the same podcast that we're talking about Citizen Kane, you're there still saying the best film ever made is Commando Strike at Dawn.
I guess what really made me sit up and pay attention to this film is, and Simon said this when we were watching it, is it doesn't feel like a film from the 1940s, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It feels like a very, very modern film in the way that it's shot, in the script, in the way that it's played, and how dark it can get very, very quickly.
Yeah.
It feels like a very, very modern film.
Yeah, and also, as you were just saying, naturalistic. A lot of the acting is very naturalistic. And
so naturalistic.
What I also thought was good, although they are generally stereotypical, the two... you know, the deputy and the leader who is bumped off, they're much more believable, you know, as occupiers than the usual fare that you'd see, who's sort of just sort of like goose step about and like...
Yeah. He still gets the award for most stereotypical Nazi.
Oh, for sure. His. And the best deaf award, in my opinion, has got to be the boat, the drowning.
Oh, that's
the best deaf award, isn't it?
It's so surprising how... cold and clinical and brutal that murder is. And the camera doesn't flinch. It just totally stays on the faces of the people who have just murdered somebody they all grew up with, spent their entire lives with.
Yeah, so that's best deaf award. Stereotypical Nazi is the deputy who becomes the leader. And what are you going to give it out of 5, Dan?
Oh, this is a solid 4 out of 5 for me. Love it.
You can't say that. It's got to be a 5, surely.
Oh, have I
got to give it a 5? You've been talking about this film for bloody ages. 4.5. What do you
want? All right, 5. All right.
I don't want to bend your arm.
I worry when I set this as a 5, what do we do when we get to, you know?
The Young Lions. It's a 6.
What do we do when we get to the Dirty Dozen?
Oh, dear God. Well, I'm not going
to
give...
We'll have to have a new scale.
I'm not going to give this a 5. I'm going to give it a 4 because it is very, very good and I would highly recommend it. And I'll definitely watch it again. Not immediately, but I'll definitely watch it again. You've seen it a couple of times already.
Yeah.
It is very, very good, but it's 4 out of 5 for me.
You can watch this on Amazon Prime. It's also on YouTube. Really hugely, hugely recommend this. It's a surprising film. It's a chapter that we will come back to again and again because the movie industry of the 40s in America and Britain seemed to be quite obsessed with the Norwegian front for a weird reason. And it's a whole part of the Second World War we really have forgotten about and paid very little attention to. So there we go. It's... Commandos Strike at Dawn. They really do strike at dawn as well. They have a timetable and they stick to it very, very closely.
There is just one thing we haven't talked about that I really think we need to cover.
Oh, here we go.
Right, so in the Strike at Dawn, where they've put the squibs to blow up, right, compared to where some of the grenades are thrown,
I told you about this, didn't I? Well, yeah, given that we now know that all these soldiers playing soldiers were actually soldiers,
they must have been
some of them seriously needed to have a look at their grenade throwing practice.
I know. Although they were stoned.
There's some great stuff which Simon's
one's about 4 meters off.
There's some very, very particular and they need to be particular explosions that happen as a result of commandos throwing grenades. And there's one or two commandos who, well, they're not going to play for England cricket, are they?
No, they're not. No. So next up, And I've said this before.
Go on, Simon.
I've said this before, and we didn't cover it. So look,
go on.
I can't guarantee it, but next up should be a bonus episode, I believe, on the King's Choice.
Let's have it.
Yeah, let's have it. So join us for that on the Foxhole Companion. Don't put that in, please.
Oh, my God.